Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 22nd of July, these are our main stories. The authorities in Beijing and Hong Kong have condemned an attack on China's liaison office in the territory as a challenge to the nation's sovereignty. Kenya's finance minister, Henry Rotich, has been arrested following corruption allegations connected to the construction of two dams. And Israeli bulldozers have started demolishing homes in a Palestinian village near Israel's separation barrier. Also in this podcast, the Myanmar journalist who is in hiding after receiving death threats for reporting on human rights abuses. The mystery of the stressed cows in France, but is it down to the presence of nearby wind farms?
The cows get stressed. Their milk is of lower quality, fertility decreases, their digestion suffers. It's stress.
L'animal est stressé.
And stress means laying the animals open to all kinds of health problems, viruses, low immunity and so on.
And the Swedish car manufacturer Volvo is recalling more than 500,000 cars worldwide over concerns about possible engine fires. We begin in Hong Kong, which was shocked by a night of violence on Sunday. Dozens of masked men in white shirts stormed a train station. There were some reports that they might be triad gangsters. They assaulted pro-democracy protesters and passers-by in the Yuen Long area. At least 45 people were injured. This is the first time this kind of violence has been seen in the ongoing anti-extradition demonstrations. Several lawmakers questioned why police were slow to arrive at the scene. Hong Kong Police Commissioner Stephen Lowe defended his officers' actions.
We received the call and respond to the scene, and only because we have to redeploy manpower from other districts, that's why the time has taken a little bit longer.
So who were these men dressed in white and wielding sticks, and who organised them? Our Asia-Pacific editor is Michael Bristow.
Well, we don't know who these people were at the moment, but the pertinent word there is organised. They do appear to have been organised. They were all wearing the same T-shirts, white T-shirts. They were all carrying similar weapons, big, long wooden and metal sticks. And they went about their act in an organised fashion, essentially attacking pro-democracy protesters as they were returning home from a rally earlier on in the evening. There's been suggestions in Hong Kong that these people are linked to triad gangs. These are criminal gangs in Hong Kong, but that's not been substantiated. The police chief, who we heard from a few moments ago, defended police action, saying it wasn't an organised operation in cahoots with the police. They knew nothing about it. But there are still questions to be answered. So, for example, why the police took a long time to come? Why, indeed, they closed the police station as well in that area just before these attacks took place? So still a lot of questions that need answers on that.
And the national emblem came under attack, and there has been condemnation. Tell us about that.
Well, yes, this is an emblem which was above the main door of the Chinese central government office in Hong Kong. So far, protesters who've been rallying just about every week for the last 2 months have avoided this office. But this is where they went on Sunday. And it's quite symbolic to throw black ink on it to deface the emblem. It was quickly replaced by the officials inside there. But it's quite symbolic. And there's been wide condemnation from Carrie Lam and from the Chinese authorities.
Our correspondent in Beijing, Celia Hatton, told the BBC's former China editor, Carrie Gracie, about the reaction to all this in mainland China.
Beijing's language today has been very strong. Last night it issued a statement saying that this kind of attack was intolerable. It said that this kind of attack, that the attack on the liaison office was a blatant challenge to the central government. And so it's really taking away the softer language it's been using in past weeks. And it's really making it very, very clear that it sees the decision by the protesters yesterday, these pro-democracy protesters. Originally, their protest route was supposed to go away, far away from the liaison office. Protesters protesters instead push through police barricades and move towards that liaison office. And I think that that really has set off alarm bells in Beijing. They're really seeing this as a direct challenge, as they say.
And then turning briefly to the other incident, of course, Beijing over the past couple of months has presented the demonstrators as lawbreakers, prepared, for example, on the 1st of July to deface the Legislative Assembly building, etc. But I guess it won't be doing much in terms of propaganda with the images of, these thugs attacking civilians getting off trains.
Well, no, it's not doing much, particularly with that propaganda, but it is not stopping many people inside mainland China from applauding the actions of those men dressed in white. We're seeing posts on social media platforms inside mainland China that are calling those men national heroes. They're calling them heroes in white. And those posts have not been taken down. But there is evidence that perhaps posts that were calling out the violence at that Yuanlong station have been scrubbed from the internet. And so you can just tell by what the censors are doing inside mainland China that they're not stopping the sort of national sentiment being whipped up that has really been speaking out against those pro-democracy protesters for the past few weeks.
That was Celia Hatton in Beijing. And we also heard from Michael Bristow. To Kenya now, where the finance minister Henry Rotich has been arrested and is due to face court charges after the director of public prosecution accused him and several other government officials of corruption. This follows a police investigation into a dam project involving an Italian construction company. Tens of millions of dollars of public funds are reported to have been paid out, but the two dams were never built. Mr. Rotich has previously denied any wrongdoing. Kenya is routinely hit by high-level corruption scandals, but senior officials are rarely arrested. Our correspondent in Nairobi is Ferdinand Omondi.
Henry Rotich surrendered moments after Kenya's public prosecutor announced that the finance minister was facing corruption charges related to the construction of two dams. The public prosecutor, Nurdin Haji, said Mr. Rotich had flouted procurement procedures when he awarded multi-million dollar tenders to an Italian construction company. Mr. Haji is also investigating how the tender was inflated by more than $170 million from the initial contract signed. In a press conference, he said colossal amounts were unjustifiably and illegally paid out through a well-choreographed scheme by government officers in collusion with private individuals and institutions. Millions of dollars have already been paid out for projects which are either incomplete or have yet to begin. The public prosecutor is also questioning how the tenders were awarded to a struggling company that was approaching voluntary liquidation back in Italy at the time.
Ferdinand Omondi. Israeli bulldozers have started demolishing homes in a Palestinian village near Israel's separation barrier. Israel says the buildings are illegal and pose a security risk. This, the reaction of the Palestinian Authority.
These houses are permitted by the Palestinian Ministry of Local Government because they are located in Area A, so the residents have permits to build there. Now the permits are being violated by the Israeli occupation forces. This military doesn't care about the international law nor humanitarian law, and doesn't respect or care about any human rights.
The words of Palestinian Authority Minister Walid Asaf. Last week, the UN appealed for the demolitions to be halted. Our Middle East analyst is Alan Johnston.
The Israelis came in the early hours around 2 a.m. local time to this small area, and they came in strength, about 700 police and soldiers accompanied by bulldozers. And we've just been watching footage from the area of one of those huge claw mechanical devices tearing down walls and crashing through ceilings and so on. About 10 buildings would be expected to be taken down, half of them half built, but there are about 17 residents who will lose their homes today.
And why is Israel doing this?
This village lies in a complicated bit of geography at the very heart of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. It sits on the edge of East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. All of this territory that was occupied by the Israelis in 1967. And through this area snakes the Israeli security barrier, which was built to prevent Palestinian suicide bombers and other attackers targeting the cities of Israel. And an Israeli court has said that these buildings are just too close to the security barrier, suggesting that they might provide cover for attackers who might threaten security personnel manning that Israeli security barrier.
We heard a little bit from the Palestinian Authority Minister, Waleed Assaf. What else are we hearing from the Palestinians?
Well, of course, they're appalled by what's happening. They say some of this area, at least, lies in territory controlled by the Palestinian Authority and that the PA has the right to grant people permission to build homes there. The Palestinians will accuse Israel of using security matters as a pretext to force people from their homes. They'll see this all as part of a long-running, wider effort by Israel to exert more and more control over the West Bank. And of course, the Palestinians want the West Bank to one day form an independent state of their own.
That was Alan Johnston. To the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the Ebola outbreak in the northeast of the country has been declared an international health emergency. Ebola has killed more than 1,700 people since DR Congo's 10th outbreak began last August. As you probably know, the virus is highly contagious, killing about half of those it strikes. That's why people who survive Ebola can be really helpful to the health services there. Paul Hawkins spoke to Adrian Blomfield of the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph. He's just been to the city of Beni in Nord Kivu province, where he spoke to some Ebola survivors.
The mental state of survivors is remarkably robust given what they've gone through. And they're playing an absolutely critical role there. Both, I divide it into the psychological and the almost the evangelical. But within these, frankly, very grim Ebola centres, they're there to offer people comfort and almost a chance of recovery. When you're admitted with Ebola, it is a terrifying thing. You get taken into this center, you're put into an isolation cube made of plastic. The only contact that you have with the outside world would ordinarily be with doctors dressed as astronauts. But in each cube, you have a survivor because they are immune to the disease, who is there, who's dressed in normal clothes, who can really hold your hand and talk to patients and said, I've been through this before, you can get through it too.
Yeah, well, that's interesting you say, holding your hand, talking to patients. And that's interesting because there is a big stigma attached to Ebola. How do they approach then going back out into the community and not face being stigmatised or trying to deal with possibly being stigmatised?
Well, I think a lot of them do face stigma. And this is one of the other roles that survivors, though, do play, because there's been a huge amount of what aid workers called community resistance, people who don't believe in the North Kivu area that Ebola actually exists. The conspiracy theories abound. It's a very traumatized community, which has been in the grip of conflict for more than 20 years. Survivors, most of them come from the local Nande ethnic group, and they can go in and speak to people in their own language and say, look, I went through this. This is what happens. It is a real disease. And that does seem to be having an impact because people are now saying, OK, well, maybe this does actually exist. And so they're starting to take more precautions like reporting victims or bringing victims into treatment centres, practising safe funerals and so on.
Adrian Blomfield of The Daily Telegraph. In France, some farmers have been trying to solve a mystery. Their animals are behaving strangely, some are even dying, and no one is sure why. Some think the answer could be electromagnetic radiation caused by nearby wind farms, but there's no scientific evidence to show a link between the two phenomena, and it all adds up to a perplexing situation. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield reports from Western France.
This is the dairy farm of Didier and Muriel Potihorn, not far from the city of Nantes. Everything was thriving here until 2012, which was when six huge wind turbines were put up in fields next to the farm. According to the Potihorn, the change was immediate and shocking. The cattle started showing signs of stress. Milk rates fell sharply. Animals started dying. Here's Muriel Potihorn.
There were problems at calving. There was poor immunity in the first milk, so calves were dying. Then we found cows dead in the sheds where they sleep. No explanation. Cows that were constantly tired, that wouldn't eat or drink. That was when we started asking questions.
Yes, it does all sound completely crazy, but then consider this. Vets have established there's no disease or sanitation problem. The Potihor are good farmers. Second, their cattle unquestionably are suffering. And third, there's a correlation in time. The automatic milking machine proves that productivity went down just when the wind turbine started. So what's going on? One group of farmers believes it knows. This is a meeting of the Association Animals Under Tension, which campaigns for recognition of their theory that electromagnetic fields created by power lines or wind farms or even phone antennae cause serious harm to farm animals. Its president is Serge Probeau.
The cows get stressed. Their milk is of lower quality, fertility decreases, their digestion suffers. It's stress.
L'animal est stressé.
And stress means laying the animals open to all kinds of health problems, viruses, low immunity, and so on. Stress is not good.
Le stress, c'est pas bon.
There is one big problem, though, and a glaring one, the total absence of evidence. True, it's recognised that animals are more sensitive to electricity than humans are, but at the Potiron farm, for example, there's no detectable electromagnetic abnormality.
Claude Allo, je suis président du GPSE, qui est le groupement.
There is actually in France an official body that looks into problems linked to electricity and farm animals. It's called the GPSE. Its president, Claude Allo, said that of 18 serious cases in recent years, which he's looked into where farmers said they were affected by electromagnetic waves, in 14 it was easily shown that that was not the problem. Claude Allo says that more money needs to be spent on researching what happens underground. Could it be that big construction projects like wind farms disrupt the subsoil, releasing water into fissures in the ground that can then carry electric current? It all still sounds far-fetched. But then there is a puzzle here. Animals are suffering, and no one can work out why.
That was Hugh Schofield in Paris. Still to come in this podcast, an attempt by a Frenchman to fly across the English Channel on a hoverboard. Aung Mam U is a journalist in Myanmar who's in hiding after police tried to arrest him for reporting on alleged human rights abuses. His reports have covered Rakhine State, a region which the United Nations has described as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya minority. Charged under an internationally criticised law, which has seen more than 50 reporters in the Asian country detained, Aung Mam fears he will be tortured if jailed. Our correspondent Mike Thompson managed to speak to him from his secret location. What crimes was he accused of?
We don't know exactly on what articles we have been charged with. We are not clear on that. But I suspect that because we report a lot, not only the fighting between the Burmese army and the RK army, and also the right abuses, and also sometimes we report the Muslim situation in northern part of RK state. So I think because of our reportings, especially the Myanmar army, they don't want any information outreach to the international community.
And what sort of abuses against Rohingya people have you witnessed and been reporting on?
Like a few months ago, they dropped a bomb. Why the Muslim people, they are looking for bamboo. They are cutting the bamboos and some Muslims were killed.
They dropped a bomb on them?
With the helicopter, a military helicopter, a bomb.
Do you think they were deliberately targeted?
Yeah, I think at that time they thought that there will be the RK army troop there. So that's why they dropped the bomb. So many people killed.
How tough is life in Rakhine or Arakan state, as the other name for it, for Muslim Rohingya people?
It is very difficult because they have been abused by the authorities during the military operation in 2017. Some Muslim people didn't want to flee from their homes. So those people were brutally killed by the army troops. And also some were beaten to death.
It's also very difficult for you there at the moment. I'm told that in addition to being pursued by police, you've also received death threats. Do you know who's made these threats and why?
I think it is the ones who are supporting the army. And so it is because we report a lot about the current situation in Arakan State, and also they thought that we give information to the international community. That's why they don't want the information out. So that's why they give us the life-threatening letter.
You've had to flee from Yangon, the capital, because you only narrowly avoided arrest. And as we speak, you're still in hiding. How long do you think you can continue to avoid arrest?
I'm not sure. You know, I've been hiding in undisclosed place for almost 3 months now. So I don't know for how long I will be hiding. I'm very much worried about my security because when one person get arrested, they torture and beaten for days and night, and they didn't give any food and water, you know, especially the SB special branch and also the military intelligence. It is usual in Burma.
Aung Mam U speaking to Mike Thompson from a secret location. The Swedish car maker Volvo says it will recall more than 500,000 cars worldwide, including nearly 70,000 in the UK, because of concerns about possible engine fires. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
The recall concerns cars with four-cylinder diesel engines manufactured over the past 5 years. Volvo says that in rare cases, the plastic intake manifold, which supplies air to the engine, can melt and deform. In a few cases, this has caused localised fires in the engine bay. The company says it's contacting all affected customers. It's working on a solution, which it says will be rolled out as soon as it's available, although it has not yet indicated when that will be. It says it's taking full responsibility for the safety standards of its cars and will do its utmost to limit any inconvenience to their owners.
That was Theo Leggett. This Thursday, a Frenchman will attempt to fly across the English Channel on a hoverboard. Frankie Zapata is a former jet ski racer who has invented a jet-powered hoverboard. His demonstration flight in front of President Macron during Bastille Day celebrations in Paris last week became a viral sensation. The clip shows an anonymous flying soldier zooming above the clouds with a rifle in his hand. That was Mr. Zapata, and he was asked about the challenges involved in his latest adventure.
4 months ago, the flyboard was just able to fly for 6 minutes, and me, I wasn't able to fly more than 130 kilometers per hour, so I wasn't able to cross the distance. But now, so I increased the speed and I increased the flying time, so I'm able to cross the channel, but that was the higher challenge. We have a refueling in the middle. I land, I change the backpack, and I take off again. It's not easy when you fly. You know, you have to stress your muscle, your leg, to be able to resist to the wind. And also, technically, it's not so easy, and then you cannot do any mistake, because if you do a mistake, you crash, and if you crash bad. So it's not something that we can sell, or it's not something for everybody. The hardest point for me is just to fail. And if I fail, if I don't fly at the right speed, I would just have to stop the machine and jump in the water. But we have all my team for the safety, even one helicopter that will follow me. So it's not something dangerous. It's just something like I have to push myself at the end, you know, and for this challenge. I have to fly very fast, the longest distance I ever flew. So this is hard, but it's not dangerous.
Please don't try this at home. That was Frankie Zapata. And good luck to him for his mission on Thursday. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And thank you for the emails regarding our moon landing special podcast, especially to Glenn Muirhead from South Africa, whose older siblings remember watching it on the neighbours' TV back in his native England. Thank you too to Marcelo Cortez in Chile and Zaha Zand, who said kind things on Twitter using the Global News Pod hashtag. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.